I'd like to have a good afternoon, Chairman Anderson, fellow board members. I'm Clayton Krager. I'm with the TMDL unit reporting on their behalf today regarding the matter of the TMDL. And we're speaking specifically today to the nutrients, dissolved oxygen, organic matter, and chlorophyll A TMDLs. We previously addressed you regarding the temperature TMDL. The purpose today is to present the approach and results of the staff's draft Klamath River TMDL for these constituents. It is the technical analysis, and it is an informational item only for your consideration today. A little bit of an overview on our presentation topics. We're going to review some of the context for this TMDL that you've seen in the past, but it'll kind of be a refresher for some of those elements. Present our analytic approach for these components, the dissolved oxygen, nutrients, total nitrogen, total phosphorus, organic matter, and chlorophyll A. And then we'll review our draft load allocations. And I'd just like to underscore the word draft there because there may be some changes. We're still working on it a little bit, but they haven't been finalized through a peer review process yet. The first part of this overview is I'd like to go over our schedule again, some of which has already occurred. In July 08, we first approached you all about with a general informational item on the Klamath TMDL. And then in September, we reviewed the technical component related to temperature. And then today, we're providing you with an update on our DO TMDL. In January, we'll be submitting our staff report for peer review, and we're on schedule to get that completed. In addition to that, at your January board meeting, we'd like to provide you with the final element of the TMDL, which is the implementation plan. We're going to provide an update on that as well. In spring, after we've addressed any peer review comments that we've received, we'll be releasing a public review draft, and there'll be a board workshop at that time. And then all of this in preparation for a board hearing by December 09.
But is the workshop date known?
No, we have not set that yet.
I was trying to plan vacation.
You take your vacation, we'll skip for it. Just recall that this is a bi-state TMDL. We're doing this in collaboration with EPA Region 10, Oregon DEQ, and with EPA Region 9 as well. And the river is listed in both states as impaired. There's a lot of overlap between the parameters that the river is listed for in both Oregon and California. It's a result of being subject to similar stressors, and lucky for us, the wording on these items is slightly different. The set of management measures to address these would be very similar. You'll see an item here. Listed here at the bottom, microcystin. While this TMDL, that was a later listing. This TMDL had been underway for a few years when that listing occurred. And so this TMDL does not explicitly address microcystins. Many of the underlying issues that relate to that microcystin will be addressed. So it's a similar overlap of stressors and management measures. Okay, this slide is to establish what is the relationship, what is going on here with these stressors? What is it that's driving the impairment in the Klamath River as far as these constituents go? And what we see in the Klamath is an elevated level of nutrients, that's total nitrogen and total phosphorus. And this is a violation of our biostimulatory substances narrative criteria. And what it does is it promotes aquatic plant growth. And there are some secondary repercussions from that aquatic plant growth, the excess stimulation of the aquatic plant growth from these elevated levels of nutrients that contribute to low dissolved oxygen. And that occurs in several ways. One is with aquatic plants, both algae and macrophytes, you see photosynthesis, which pumps oxygen into the water column, and you see respiration, which extracts oxygen from the water column. And when the algae dies, when it goes into senescence, it decays, and that decay process also chews up oxygen. So the nutrients are driving this secondary effect by stimulating excess plant growth. In addition to that, that same diurnal cycle of photosynthesis and respiration also drives extreme day-night extremes of pH. The Klamath River is a weakly buffered water, meaning that it's easily subject to pH changes, is the simplest way to put that. And that the photosynthesis and respiration cycle can drive extremes of pH in the Klamath River, and does. The other effect is that there's a promotion of blue-green algae. And these blue-green algae blooms also have a toxigenic component. There are toxic blooms, and you'll hear more about that after my talk today. But in a sense, they've become, that's the microcystin part that you saw in the previous listing. It also promotes dense growths of attached algae. This is called periphyton. And the periphyton is attached to the bottom of the river, and this has several effects. It tends to drive the pH and the DO cycle, but it can also create a lot of organic matter that then depresses, when it decays, it depresses the DO further. It's also tied to some of the fish disease issues in that it provides habitat for some of the vectors associated with the fish disease that we see in the Klamath River. So it's become habitat for some, one of the components of that. And then I've spoken to the organic enrichment is from this excess algae and excess periphyton, the growth that you see a lot of excess organic matter, which is then decays and uses up a lot of oxygen. Combined, these effects lead to impacts on beneficial uses. Now, the basin plan includes, in total, it lists 27 possible beneficial uses. Of those 27 possible beneficial uses, 23 of them apply to the Klamath River as either existing or potential. Of those 23 beneficial uses, 17 of them are impaired or impacted by those processes that I just described. And what I have on the slide up here, those that are marked with the red arrow are those beneficial uses which have been impacted and are in fact, the cause of the listing of the Klamath River as impaired. Now, this slide is to illustrate the complex series of relationships that exist and that we are attempting to arrive at a better understanding of how this is a conceptual model. And it's a ecological risk model, and it was developed by EPA in 1998 for ecosystem assessment. And it shows at the top here in red, this level is the driver or stressor. This is the component that is causing the impact, or at least the impact that we are assessing on the ecosystem. The next level down are environmental conditions. These are response variables in the water column, such as dissolved oxygen. Those are then linked to response or outcome variables such as fish population, fish health. And these things are then linked in the bottom to our endpoint, our risk assessment endpoint, which are beneficial use impacts. And what I'm going to do here today is demonstrate one of those pathways. You can see in lighter gray, I've kind of muted some of the relationships which this TMDL involves. The red line represents one of those components, and that is the increased nutrient loading leads to elevated periphyton and macrophyte growth, which leads to increased diurnal DO fluctuation, which leads to a decrease in the overall dissolved oxygen. This is very stressful to fish and fish populations, and thus it's associated with many of these elements within the response outcome, leading to, eventually, lower overall fish populations. Therefore, that pathway is linked to impairment in each one of those boxes that are highlighted in red at the bottom, each one of those beneficial uses. And what the Regional Board staff has done, it has compiled data on each one of these components, the linkage, environmental monitoring, or through a modeling analysis, to determine, you know, what the appropriate levels are to restore supporting conditions to the beneficial uses. So this conceptual model helps us track and understand the myriad of impacts and relationships that we have to address through the TMDL. So you heard me talk previously about this stimulated and excess plant growth. And these are some photographs that help to identify those conditions as they exist in the Klamath River today. This is one of the reservoir inlets, and it's this not usually this soupy green color. That is the blue-green algae that you heard me mention. This, it doesn't show up exactly, but you can actually see the blue-green algae organisms in this photograph if you look closely on your that's why I printed out the special copy. And that blue-green algae has a special capability to rise and lower within the water column on a diurnal basis, a daytime-nighttime basis. And it gives them a special advantage relative to other algal species. This is some of the sampling program that the Karuk tribe has been doing of the reservoirs. And it becomes literally, especially in wind-driven, as it gets driven into these inlets, becomes very viscous, and it's almost pudding-like how thick it is in terms of the concentration of this toxic blue-green algae. And I've included this photograph of the ducks in these inlets, which feed near shore. We don't have specific data on the impacts to ducks, but you saw we listed wildlife. And this toxic blue-green algae is toxic to many forms of wildlife and has that impact which led to the listing for that reason. Then we also have, in the lower below Iron Gate Dam, we also have effects. And what you see here is a different type of algae. It's the attached algae. This is the periphyton of which I spoke. It's attached to the cobble and rocks on the bottom of the river. And you can see that we develop some really long strands here. That was a piece of monitoring equipment that was left in for one season, and that's the algal growth that occurred on it in that one season. We have evaluated what we believe to be the proper density for periphyton in the stream, and the Klamath River exceeds it by orders of magnitude in terms of the effect on water chemistry and organic enrichment and decay. So we have these impacts below the dams. In addition to that, we also have the phytoplankton and blue-green algae now below the dams. The river has been inoculated with releases from the reservoir of blue-green algae. And we're seeing in backwater pools scums beginning to form. And this is especially bad because these are the areas where people are most likely to have contact with the water. And we also see that wildlife comes into contact with it there as well as people. And so you saw the culture use was impaired, and this is largely a reason for that, because to come into contact with blue-green algae, as you'll hear a little bit more about later, it can cause all kinds of skin disorders, and it's actually a liver toxin as well. Okay, so the purpose of the TMDL. You've heard something about the impairments that we have there. It's to establish the pollutant loads, the reductions expressed as allocations. You'll hear me say allocations, and sometimes allocations don't always mean this, but in this case they do almost in every case on the climate. It means some level of reduction to be able to restore water quality conditions that are supportive of beneficial uses, where water quality objectives are met. And this attainment of allocations means that we're meeting water quality standards, and it means TMDL compliance. Anytime you hear me use the term TMDL compliance, it means all those other factors are in effect, that allocations are being met and that water quality standards are being met. So how did we go about this? Well, we've used a series of models that are tailored to the conditions on the river. And when the river is a free-flowing river, we've used RMA. When it's impounded, we've used the CQOL W2. And to ensure that we're not just meeting conditions in the river and still impairing waters downstream, we've included a model for the estuary, EFDC, which helps us evaluate not only are we meeting conditions in the water column in those areas where we have jurisdiction, it's also meeting water quality standards downstream of that, because we don't want to create a problem downstream. In addition to that, a lot of environmental data has been collected on the Klamath River by a number of agencies, and there's been a remarkable level of cooperation in sharing data on the Klamath Basin amongst all the agencies and private entities that are working there. And we've tried to take advantage and secure all of that and use that in our analysis, which is guided in part by that conceptual model that I illustrated earlier, where we try to identify what's going on with this particular linkage. And then there's also a large number of reports that we've studied and evaluated and using as another line of evidence to help us determine what are the appropriate allocations for the Klamath River for these constituents. So, attainment, the way our approach is primarily in the modeling analysis. You heard how the nutrients drive conditions that impact dissolved oxygen. So the modeling endpoint for our allocations primarily, not exclusively, but primarily was dissolved oxygen. And so we were evaluating those levels of nutrients and organic matter that would allow the dissolved oxygen objective to be attained. That was our primary approach. These nutrient and organic matter reductions are also needed to control other biostimulatory conditions. You've heard me talk about algal density, other reasons for controlling algal density as well, the toxigenic components and the effect on fish disease. And so we were looking at that as well. Now, what better for the 10,000-foot level view that you all need but a 10,000-foot level view? And so this is the upper Klamath Basin here. This is Klamath Falls. This purple star is related to, that's the very bottom end of upper Klamath Lake. These are point source discharges around Lake Awana, right in here. And this part is the Klamath Straits drain, which is an input from the irrigation Lost River area into the Klamath River. And there are some very large loads from the upper basin. The Klamath River is known as what's an upside-down river, in that most rivers are pristine and pure in their upper reaches and become more polluted as they go downstream. The Klamath River is flatter, it's more eutrophic, and it becomes cleaner and has a higher gradient as you move downstream. In fact, the tribes have called it the River of Renewal for that reason, because it does have sort of a self-cleansing characteristic because of that. So this is the upper basin. These are the headwaters. And I wanted to show in particular that these numbers may not mean anything to you, but these are very large numbers in terms of sources of loading, this 818,000 pounds per year from upper Klamath Lake that comes down through the system and into the Klamath River in California. And the same, these Oregon point sources, 58,000 pounds, and then for Klamath Straits drain, which is what we call a discrete non-point source because it comes in at a single point, 96,000 pounds. So there's some large loads in the upper basin that we're looking at. Okay, so we're going to step through our allocations step by step. And so we start at the Oregon-California state line. That's an allocation compliance point. Then we have the main stem here, and there are several compliance points along the main stem. COPCO 1 and 2 and Iron Gate Reservoir are a compliance point. Iron Gate Hatchery is a compliance point. The primary tributaries, Shasta, Scott, Salmon, and Trinity, are compliance points. And then we have all the other tributaries in the main stem as compliance points. And then ultimately we have the Pacific Ocean and the estuary as kind of our final test case of did we get it right once we've controlled all the sources from here to here. So we're going to step through our allocations, not for each one of these because we've grouped them to kind of abbreviate some of this, but through the primary ones. So this is a summary of our allocations. And what we have here are the parameters along the top for which we're talking about today. Total phosphorus and total nitrogen. When you hear me talk about nutrients, that's what I'm talking about. Organic matter, dissolved oxygen, and chlorophyll A. Chlorophyll A is an indicator for biomass, algal biomass, not paraphyton, for phytoplankton, floating algal biomass. It's a component of the photosynthetic pigment that you can relate to how much biomass is there in the water column. So for each one of these, we have the location, state line, COPCO reservoirs, Iron Gate Hatchery, and the tributaries. And then wherever you see a little Christmas tree, we have an allocation for that. And just as a reminder, today we're only talking about these parameters and not the temperature allocations, which you were briefed on previously. So the load allocations at state line, there's some important background information to understand here. And this is our current understanding, and as I mentioned, these are draft allocations and may change slightly, but not significantly. These load allocations are to sources in Oregon, are part of Oregon DEQ's Klamath TMDL already. So there are, Oregon, as I've mentioned, is our collaborator in this. And to achieve water quality standards in Oregon, they had to provide these allocations for their waters as well. They weren't required solely for California. They're necessary to meet the Oregon criteria, in other words. Attainment of Oregon criteria also meets California water quality standards at state line. And that was a condition of our memorandum of agreement. And that's with the modeling analysis, we were able to achieve allocations in Oregon that satisfied both conditions, Oregon criteria and California water quality standards. These load reductions at the Oregon-California line reflect upstream reductions. So what we've asked for at the California line, it's contingent on achieving the TMDL objectives above the state of California state line to be able to meet those at that allocation compliance at the California state line. So what are those draft allocations at state line? And this map, again, I've included here is the basin. And then at state line, and we mean state line, these are the total phosphorus, total nitrogen, and organic matter current load on the left, and then the allocation on the right. And you can see that from existing conditions to TMDL compliant conditions, there are some large reductions we're talking about. From 750,000 to 125,000 is about a 76, 78, 80% reduction in the current loads. So there's some dramatic work that has to be done to achieve that objective. The same for the other constituents, 3 million pounds to 1.3 million pounds, a similar level. Organic matter, from 19 million pounds to 10 million pounds. So, got a lot of work cut out for us. Okay, the draft allocations for Iron Gate and COPCO reservoirs. Okay, so this is just to orient you to where we're at next year. We're moving down from state line to the reservoirs. Okay. Within the reservoirs, we see that both oxygen and temperature conditions are impacted. The impoundments, in and of themselves, provide slower movement and unshaded water that allows greater expression of nutrient impacts. And that means that when you pool water and you allow sunlight to it, it's going to have a more dramatic effect, a more biostimulatory effect than if it's moving and cooler and shaded. So this increased susceptibility leads to nuisance algal blooms, as I showed, demonstrated through the photographs. However, reservoirs are a controllable factor, and so we have some allocations for them. This is one of the effects I wanted to walk you through, and this is an important effect because even after loads upstream are controlled, this effect remains, and it's a temperature and dissolved oxygen effect. So even after we've controlled the nutrient organic matter loads from upstream, we will still see this condition in the reservoirs, and it's due to what's called stratification. During summer, large still water bodies will become stratified into two layers. In the top layer, we have a depth above which minimum DO objective is met. In the bottom layer, we have a depth below which the temperature target is met. What we have in the middle is a zone where neither DO objective or temperature target are met. The temperature is too high and the dissolved oxygen is too low to provide supporting conditions for coal beneficial use. And this is a function of the reservoir, and it's because the water is stagnant or still. So what we've done is we've constructed a allocation to address this condition, and now you see here in the middle of this green layer is what we call the compliance lens. And the compliance lens is a zone where overlapping temperature and DO conditions are supporting of cold conditions. And what this takes is an infusion of oxygen or circulation of water to create this zone. And this zone, in terms of trying to be fair, rather than having the entire water column meet both the temperature and oxygen conditions, we've defined it as the width of the reservoir, the length of the reservoir, and the depth of the incoming river. So not for the entire water column, but simply this lens, which is marked here in green. So we've converted the purple zone that does not meet the dissolved oxygen and temperature conditions into a zone that does support the beneficial use. There's another aspect of the reservoirs that have to be addressed through an allocation, and that is a release of nutrients from the sediments at the bottom of the reservoir. Conditions at the bottom of the reservoir, I've mentioned before, it's called the hypolimnion, and there's low DO and temperature. Under low dissolved oxygen, you see a release of nutrients from the sediments into the water column. And this happens during a critical period, the summer. And this is, so it contributes to existing biostimulatory conditions. So what we've said is that we have to operate the reservoirs in a manner that the allocation is equal to zero nutrient loading from reservoir sediments. We haven't specified the specific engineering approach to do that, but we believe it is possible. The third component of reservoirs that have to be addressed through an allocation is that increased susceptibility to nuisance algal blooms, and that is the chlorophyll A here. And what we've done is we've evaluated empirical data, we've reviewed literature, and we've done some modeling analyses, and what we've been able to demonstrate is that at the 10 micrograms per liter, we can control the algal biomass below nuisance conditions, below conditions that would impact beneficial uses. It reduces the percentage of the blue-green algal biomass. As As you go above 10 micrograms per liter, the proportion of that biomass that is blue-green algae also increases. And so you have a higher potential for toxigenic effects. And that reduces, by keeping it under 10, at 10 or under, we reduce the dominance of microcystis, which is the most toxic of the toxigenic component. So to summarize the reservoir allocations, you know, oxygen and temperature sufficient to create a compliance lens, zero nutrient loading from reservoir bottom sediments, and 10 micrograms per liter of chlorophyll A. And all of these will require changes in reservoir operation. The next allocation point is the Iron Gate Hatchery. It's marked there in green. It's just downstream of the Iron Gate Dam. Its overall loading to the Klamath River is less than 1% for both organic matter and nutrients. It's a very small load, but it is an NPDES facility that does require a permit. And our load allocations will be consistent with the inflow. There will be no net increase from inflow conditions. So the water that the hatchery takes in, the concentrations of nutrient organic matter can be no greater than the nutrient organic matter of which it discharges back to the river. So no net increase. The tributaries. We have the four primary, Shasta, Scott, Salmon, and Trinity, and all the other tributaries. For those, in our modeling analysis, we were able to demonstrate that the existing Shasta TMDL meets water quality conditions in the Klamath River, so therefore there are no changes necessary to the Shasta TMDL to satisfy the Klamath River TMDL. Allocations to all the other tributaries are equal to their average current conditions. What this means is we have to hold the line. There can be no net increase above current conditions, but there won't be any requirements for reductions. The tributary allocations do not address the Lost River tributary, which is addressed through other TMDLs, the Lost River having an engineered connection to the Klamath River through, like, the Klamath Straits drain. Is being addressed by Oregon DEQ is developing for a portion of the Lost River within Oregon, and EPA Region 9 is developing a TMDL for the Lost River component within California. And if those TMDLs will address the allocations that are necessary there. So in conclusion, the allocations at state line require substantial reductions from sources within Oregon, consistent with the ODEQ TMDL. Reservoirs affect water quality, and it will require changes in reservoir operations. The Shasta TMDL are consistent with the Klamath River TMDL, and other tributaries are equal to current conditions. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Right. If Shasta is consistent, is your word, does that mean the Scott's not then?
No, the Scott River is, we've allocated it. It's one of the major tributaries, but what we've determined is that its existing concentration levels for both the wet season and the dry season, those are adequate to meet Klamath TMDL conditions. And the Scott.
Just to clarify that the Scott River wasn't a TMDL for nutrients.
That's what I was
going to
add as well, Matt,
St.
John, of your staff.
It's all TMDLs at 10 to 3.
Just to elaborate, so the Scott River TMDL didn't have any allocations associated with nutrients or organic matter.
Right. So, and just in on it, other than to say, I guess, you know, you want more comments and we'll tell you to start over or something. One thought passed through my brain when you're talking about the fish hatchery and no net increase, and what does that mean in terms of, you know, I can understand it from this process, but currently are they changing? Is there a significant change from water going in and coming out of a hatchery, or is it fairly benign?
Well, it's a, as I noted, it's a very small component of the overall loading, but they do have a net increase on the water which they intake and then relative to their discharge. So there's a net increase from their operations to both nutrients and organic matter.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that hatchery, but you know, it operates differently during different times of the year. The fish are bigger, they contribute more because they're bigger, and how do we handle those kind of variations?
Well, this hatchery, I'm not the engineer working on that, but it is, it's in a very constrained space, and their funding is very limited, and they have a fairly rudimentary process now. They have settling ponds that are likely undersized relative to their function to serve as settling ponds. I don't think they're very effective. And so I'm not exactly sure how, to be honest, how they're going to meet these conditions.
Now, I don't mean to get into detail of that operation of more than just as a conception reaction to, as a PowerPoint, as an explanation, it makes sense. But I suspect the pig will squeal here eventually in a variety of different places as people figure out what it means. And
well, that's part of the purpose of the conclusions, is that, as you'll see in the upcoming there's some significant implementation questions and issues relative to the loads from the upper basin. Reservoir operations are going to be somewhat controversial, and the discharge from the hatchery is going to be an issue that I'm sure the board will be hearing more about. And so we tried to tee you up for some of the things we think you might be hearing about in the future.
And I, you know, I guess it's always helpful, as you say, it's a less than 1%, the hatchery, it's not, it may not be a big item, but it may get a lot of focus. I don't know if it'll fall out at the end.
If I could just, you know, remind all of us of what the charge is for a TMDL project, and it is to evaluate all of the sources that are contributing to a water quality problem. So that's what we've done. And Iron Gate Hatchery is one of those sources. Its contribution, when we look at the entire Klamath River, is very small. But what the Clean Water Act tells us is that we have to control the controllable sources, and the hatchery is certainly one. And the allocation that we've given it is actually quite reasonable. We've simply said, don't worsen water quality conditions. Don't add load to it. So we're not asking them to improve it beyond the condition that they take it in. They take in water from Iron Gate Reservoir at an impaired condition, and we're asking them, don't make it any worse. We're actually not asking them to clean it up beyond what they take it in at. And we are having discussions with the Department of Fish and Game to talk about the details of this allocation, and so those conversations are ongoing.
And is a generic thing, is if somebody has an allocation and they have to clean up something, can they clean up somewhere else, or are they required to work in their own backyard, or how does that work?
It's a great question, Chairman Anderson, and there is definitely opportunity within the TMDL world to have what we call trading. We're all becoming more and more familiar with the concept of carbon trading in air, you know, dealing with global climate change. And there are models for doing that in water quality improvement projects as well. And so one of the things that the implementation framework will be identifying is those opportunities. And one of the particular complexities of the Klamath is that we're a bi-state watershed. And so we're currently working on developing an MOA with Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, as well as the two EPA regions, to talk about how we're going to work together in implementing these TMDLs. And one of the things that we've discussed, and may be a component in the MOA, though the specifics have yet to be determined, is this concept of trading.
And I'm on page 13 of our presentation. It's the COPCO 1 and 2 and RNJ reservoir allocation summary. Everyone has that. Zero nutrient loading from reservoir bottom sediments. And I guess just if they're there and doing bad things, but they're there, and how do we work on that problem?
It's related to the stratification, and I kind of blitzed over the explanation because it has to do with the effect of the water column at a zero dissolved oxygen or near zero dissolved oxygen calls what's called a redox potential, and what it does is it will literally pull iron off of phosphorus that is being shared with phosphorus atom, and as an oxidation reaction, and it releases the phosphorus into the water column from the sediments. So if the bottom hypolimnion is aerated or circulated and those dissolved oxygen conditions don't exist, you won't see that release of nutrients into the water column, which are then taken up by algae or discharged over the tail race downstream to existing conditions that are already biostimulated.
Triggers another thought in terms of the allocation at state line, and the model assumes that good things will happen upstream. They'll take care of Oregon's problems, and what arrives in California will be at that number that we've set. What happens in the chances of that probably aren't too great, but so it doesn't happen. When it doesn't happen and you get down to the reservoirs, then somebody's working in the reservoir to make things better, are they allowed to use the number that should have been? And how does that relate to then the reality of having to work in a reservoir where that number is, could be 100 times or 10 times or some huge variation from what the model says, because it hasn't happened upstream of California. So how do we handle that actual making things better in the reservoir setting when maybe that's not the conditions that they really are working in at that point in time?
Sure. Yeah, there's no question that the Pacific Corps facilities, these hydro facilities, are the recipients of nutrients and organic matter that are beyond their control. What they are responsible for is this phenomenon that Clayton just described, which is the stratification leading to a small amount of nutrient flux out of the sediment. So we're saying you're responsible for that. So to address your question, it really comes down to a compliance time frame. And one of the reasons that we decided to include the chlorophyll A allocation for the Pacific Corps facilities is to recognize that the presence of these impoundments creates the enhancement of this biostimulatory condition. So we believe that there is some responsibility of the operators of the reservoirs to help control algal bloom conditions in conjunction with nutrient controls upstream by other responsible parties. What's not acceptable, frankly, from my standpoint, is to wait for upstream nutrient controls to happen, which could take decades, before we begin to think about the opportunities through engineered solutions for controlling algal blooms within the reservoirs. So one of the things that an implementation plan does is identifies potential implementation options. As you know, we can't prescribe an engineered fix, but we can lay out options. And we can identify a time frame in which we are looking for progress. And quite frankly, I look at the operation of these facilities similar to how we have permits, for instance, for stormwater, where we're looking at BMP implementation. And if there's actions that are taken that might represent progress towards compliance. That's my staff's opinion. I'm not the sole one writing the implementation plan, and perhaps Samantha or Kat want to comment on that as well.
Oh, I could. This is Samantha Olson, your staff counsel on this matter. We're working on the implementation plan. We'll have an update because, I mean, you see the science and the automatic questions come for implementation. We don't have it prepared yet, but I just want to caveat that implementation options on the reservoirs are different from normal discharges of waste that we're used to dealing with. It's a FERC-regulated hydro facility, and so our implementation is quite different from our normal prohibitions against specifying matter of compliance against it. So it's a different scenario, and I prefer that we just wait for the full discussion on that in January and the months to follow. But in answer to your question specifically, the reservoirs have independent contributions to the impairments, and so their implementation should be independent of the upstream sources coming into it. In other words, but for the reservoir being there, the algal blooms and nuisance conditions wouldn't be created. And so they're independently responsible to meet certain water quality requirements, regardless of the upstream inputs.
One of the things I did not mention is that the blue-green algae, the reservoirs are primarily the primary algal species that is the nuisance there. It does not grow well, if at all, in rapidly moving water. And so under model conditions, we were able to evaluate what the effect would be, under conditions with nutrients. But we evaluated this question, what the concentrations would be, under moving water, and looked at various. And yes, there is an effect of nutrients, but like Samantha said, there's a component that is independently attributable to conditions within created by the reservoir themselves.
And on the implementation plan, it's in the schedule for January. Is that a presentation to us, or it's just a document that'll be written and submitted for comment or some other process?
Samantha's drafting it. We will hope to put it out on our website early January at the latest. So at the January meeting, we wanted to go over what is in that draft document that's on our website with you.
Okay. I'm drafting it with a lot of help from Ben and Clayton as well. We may want to just do an update, but then circulate, sort of similar to what we did with the technical TMDL, circulate with the cooperating agencies first, and then let a release a public draft.
Okay, I have two speaker cards, and most other board members have questions to pepper staff with.
We'll wait till after the speakers.
Susan, go on.
Okay, wake up. So I'm doing more than 3 minutes today. I'm Susan Corum with the Creek Tribe. Susan Corum with the Creek Tribe, and your staff has known about this for a long time, so, and you knew about it too, so, and I'm glad I can be here to present this to you today, but I think if one of your staff members, I think Elmer would be giving this to you today to coordinate with the nutrient presentation, but since he's not here, I'm honored to be able to come in and explain this to you. Plus, we have two new board members who have not heard my spiel before, so please let me go through it with
you. You can listen to the tapes.
It's a lot of pictures. Did you see how many pictures it is? I'm going to go right through them when we get to my, like, four key points, and then we can... Yeah, okay. So, as Clayton was already talking about, the toxic algae that we find a lot of in the Klamath is Microcystis arginosa. It is a blue-green algae. It can appear like, can appear like little flakes, colonies where you get these big chunks, and then an oil slick where it looks like you dumped neon green antifreeze on the surface of the water. And it prefers slower, still, warm, nutrient-rich water. So I equate with saying what it likes is a really big, nutrient-rich bathtub. That's its ideal habitat. It does not like moving water. It doesn't do well. It doesn't compete well. It can also move around up and down in the water column, so it can get more light, more nutrients, whichever way it wants to be, outcompete other algaes. And it can also move around based on wind conditions. It produces a toxin called microcystin, which you already heard is a liver toxin. The toxin is released when the cells die and break open. It's three orders of magnitude higher in concentration than ickiness than your average pesticide, and it's got a steep dose response curve, which means I equate it to kind of like smoking, as you can smoke for a long time and not really see any physical health effects, but then, you know, you wind up with cancer or something like that towards the end. So you can be exposed to it and have little effects, but the really big, nasty liver damage, it takes a while to get there. So, and then it also is a known tumor promoter now, which makes it particularly nasty. Because it's a liver toxin, you need to take it in into your body. It has to go through your liver and be processed that way. So you need to drink it, eat it, inhale it, like if you were water skiing. That's actually a double whammy because you inhale the toxin becomes an aerosol and goes right into your nose, and then people also gulp it when they splash into the water. Let's see, for Oregon, actually put together guidance right now for when you shouldn't eat fish. California, OEHA, the Office of Environmental Health and Hazard Assessment, they're working on one of those right now. So we should have more information on that, which will help your staff and everybody. We're more concerned about children because it takes less amount of toxin because there are less body weight to affect them. And they also are more prone to splashing and gulping water in the reservoirs. This was like an 8-year-old kid water skiing that we watched fall down about 6 times, and the blooms were really high that day. So we're finding it. It's being found in a lot of research now that people are looking at it. They're seeing it in all different kinds of tissue. One of the things we're finding now is the study was done where it's found in the livers of hatchery chinook earlings, the tissue and livers of perch, and the mussels in Klamath River. Physiological effects is when they have lots of microcystin in hatchery-raised salmon, you get this net pen liver disease, which affects them. You can get acute liver failure. There's new links between microcystin and cardiomyopathy in sea otters, possibly. There's a bunch of people at UC Davis working on the effects that microcystin has in the delta on species, and they are finding physiological negative effects on them. And then there was also in 2007 some livestock deaths that were attributed to microcystin. There's a bunch of beneficial uses that are impacted, pretty much anything that's going to eat or drink or play in this water that's contaminated with the toxin. This all started out in 2004. I'm just going to do a tiny little timeline to see where we've progressed to. We took one sample in COPCO. The levels that we found were 1.9 million cells of Microcystis arginosa and 482 micrograms per liter of microcystin. What does this mean? At that point, all we had was the World Health Organization had guidelines for a moderate health risk for recreational bathing. In other words, if people are swimming or splashing in the water, what would be bad? Well, over 100,000 cells per milliliter would be bad, so we were exceeding that by 19 times. Over 20 micrograms per liter would be bad, we were exceeding that by 24 times. Therefore, we said, hey, we think there's a problem in these reservoirs, let's study it further, so we have been for the last several years. So our protocol for this is we do biweekly sampling for cell counts and the toxin, so we can get a good idea of like how when it comes on, when it goes away, when is it the worst. We've been working collaboratively with the Yurok tribe and with your staff and with EPA and all sorts of other people, but we coordinate our sampling with these guys to cover the whole river from Iron Gate down. We do grab samples of surface algal material. This is before we knew how bad it was and I wasn't wearing gloves. We sample on the surface and shoreline stations. So we sample out in the open water to see what the water skiers are being exposed to, what swimmers are being exposed to, and in the reservoirs we also sample on the shoreline to see when people have their dogs come drink the water, when they're playing right around the shoreline, what are they being exposed to there. We also do some sampling that's more of an ecological in like the mid-channel of the river, like where the river's flowing, see how different that is. For our cell counts, we send them to the laboratory that everybody uses, Pacific Ore, lots of other folks use, and he gets our cell counts for the toxigenic species of algae. And then for a few years, we used Dr. Wayne Carmichael at Wright State University that analyzed our toxin, and then he retired, so EPA Region 9 Lab Richmond actually started doing the samples, and that was great because we could send them free to those guys, and they do a fabulous job with it. So here's the reservoirs. Kafka was on top. Niagara's downriver. So here's a couple little pictures. You can just see. I'm going to go through these quick. I know everybody's tired. So just showing you from year to year that we are seeing similar conditions, and it's looking bad every year pretty much. There's Kafka reservoir. And then I'm going to do one data plot to show you what's happening generally from year to year. These little box plots are what the reservoir, it's like all the reservoir data combined together. So you can see that in 2005, we saw the bloom started in July, and then it got really high. There's your WHO guideline that we looked at, that lower dotted line of where you don't want to be recreating in the reservoirs when it gets above that line. So then you can see in August and September, it was almost every sample was above that line. And then it started to fade out in October, and then by November, the bloom's going away. So that's what's happening within the reservoirs. What's coming into the reservoirs is nothing, or non-detectable amounts of the toxic algae. So we're not finding any stuff coming in. We're getting these huge blooms within the reservoirs. And then what's coming out below, going into the river, like where the Proof territory is, where I work, is these little X's right here. So we're not getting as high of levels as we get in the reservoirs, about an order of magnitude less, but we are getting a discharge of the toxic algae into the free-flowing stretch of the river below. And now keep in mind, these samples are all like targeted open water and shoreline scums. These samples were all where the water's nice and mixed. So the results are different, which I'll show you in a little bit, if you start looking at shoreline scums in the river below. So that's our pattern. 2006, 2007, 2008, the only thing that really changed is sometimes it starts off in the middle of June, sometimes it starts off in the middle of July. Generally, your peak is August and September, and you're done by the end of October. So that's when your staff has been coming out and listing things like that. So 2006, still, here's your water that's going into your intake. This is the water that's going to be coming out into Klamath River. Below Iron Gate, you can see it's swirling right in. There's Kafka 2006. In 2007, before the bloom started, thanks to help from your staff and local tribes and a bunch of other people who were willing to push this and me coming to you guys doing a great job of supporting your staff in this, the state was able to get a guidance document put out for recommending when you would do postings for California. Because remember, before that, all we had was the World Health Organization. Oregon had guidance, Australia has guidance, Nebraska had guidance, but California had nothing. So this document finally got approved. And their recommendation was actually lower than the WHO guidelines. It was 40,000 cells per milliliter post instead of 100,000 cells per milliliter. Because now that more research has been done, they decided a lower amount is better. Plus, there's been correlation with our scientists that show that correlates very well with the 8 micrograms per liter. So instead of the 20, it's now down to 8. And those two overlap really well to when we find toxigenic conditions. So you can kind of either look if anything's above 40,000 cells, it's just as bad if it's above the 8 micrograms per liter of the microsystem, but it's getting technical and boring. So let's move on to pictures. Look, still bad in 2007. Yep. Okay. Now here's one of the things. We caught a bloom coming down below the reservoirs. This is in the river below, so this is something I find very interesting. We're getting microcystis scumming on the shorelines in the river below Iron Gate. That's nasty stuff, because then again, that's like where your ducks are eating, where people are recreating. We've got ceremonies happening at that time of the year. This is September. We've got people out fishing in the river for both like subsistence and for recreational use. And you can see how green the river is here. And then you can see here, and they're like, you've got plants underwater and the periphyton settling out in them. So you've got pretty good conditions. What else have we got? Also in 2007, EPA funded the state to do a tissue study, which I did present that data to you briefly in WEED, so I'm not going to go through a bunch of it if you guys remember that. And what it was is a bunch of people collected samples. Most of it was done by the California Department of Fish and Game, went out and caught perch out of the reservoirs, and that was done. So what was sampled? Some of the hatchery, yearling Chinook, one that had probably been there for about 10 or 11 months. Those were sent in. They took perch from Kafka and Iron Gate during the bloom, like in August or September, and then Assel in spring. One of the guys from EPA was up there and was able to get us some fish. So we could see, is it still, are these things were pretty high levels, were they still bad in the springtime once there wasn't any toxin in the water anymore? And then they also took mussels from the Klamath River, both during the bloom in August and then after the bloom in November when the river had cleared up. And the final report finally came out last month by the State Water Board. So I'm going to do a quick summary, just one slide on the data. What did we find? In everything we tested, if it was picked up during the bloom, there was toxin in there. For the hatchery Chinook, it was just in the livers, which makes sense because, you know, it's a liver toxin, so you would expect to find it in the liver before the mussel. It wasn't found in the mussel there. It was found in mussels, which is a subsistence food for the group tribe, which is still currently eaten, especially during ceremonies, which again happen in August and September. So that's when I know some of our technicians go out to get mussels for their ceremonies and feed them to the elders. So that's the thing we've had to put a hold on now because those aren't safe. And then they were both in the livers and the fillets of the perch, which is a really big game species in Kopko and Iron Gate Reservoir. People come pick up hundreds of them because there's no limit on it. So people come catch hundreds of them and then take them back and do like vet fish fries and stuff. So they're feeding them to our veterans, and that's not too great either. So then here's a quick little thing looking at. So then there's, you got your mussels and your perch, and this is for a child. And what this is a TDI. It's called a tolerable daily intake. And all that means is the acute TDI is, acute TDI is, can you eat it one time? Can you eat that fish one time? Is it safe? Seasonal is, can you eat the fish over like the season you'd be out hanging out in the reservoirs catching them? And a lifetime TDI is, okay, I'm going to eat this over the course of my life. Is that okay? Is it safe? So if it's over one, that means it's not safe for that thing. So we saw for the mussels, the lifetime TDI, we do not want kids eating mussels over the course of their life. Can they eat them over the season when there's the bloom happening? No. Can they eat them just once? Well, it looks like I really wouldn't recommend for the tribal members to even have their kids eating these just one time because the levels were so high. What about for adults? Not over a lifetime. I would say no for the season and getting pretty close for just eating them on one occasion, and that's kind of not good. Oh, that's, I'm sorry, that's for the perch, not for the adults. So again, that's for a perch. So you're going out and doing your recreational fishing isn't looking too good either for your kids. Now, look, for the adults, it's not so severe, but still, for the lifetime TDI for the mussels, you probably don't want to eat it over the course of your life. Eating it over the course of a season, no. An adult looks like they could eat a couple mussels and they'd be okay. And then for the perch, it looks like over a lifetime, no, which some of these people come out year after year after year. Season, well, you're kind of in that gray area, and then eating it once, they might be okay. But this was in a pretty limited data set. They did good stats on it and stuff, but still. So that was that. And then 2008, I just thought this was really interesting. We pulled up one time, and there's a bunch of cows drinking this water, and it had 1,600 micrograms per liter of microcystin, which exceeds the California guidelines for just swimming in it by 200 times, and they're drinking it. And people do sell the livers of cows for food and consumption. And then there's Kopko. And then again, I said, this is in the river below Iron Gate from 2008. So these are, like, a lot of these are the free-flowing, and I talked about we sample where the water's all mixed up. You can see they're below the guidelines for California. But then once we started sampling and the scums that we were seeing on the shorelines in the river below Iron Gate, we were seeing hits that were way above the guidelines. So again, this is the time of the year. This is September. So this is the time of year when, like, the ceremonies are happening, fishing is happening. So that's why that's a concern to us, and we'd like to do some more sampling on that in the future. So where have we gotten? When we first got here, you guys heard me come in and be all mad and nobody was doing anything about this. We have progressed a lot since 2005. We now have, like I said before, we have the recreational guidelines, voluntary guidance for harmful algal blooms, talking about how to post, when to post, things like that. And as I said, OEHA is putting out their health risk assessment for tissue, for water consumption that's contaminated with microcystin. They're doing it for humans, for wildlife, and for livestock, which is good because you've seen we have an impact on cows and deer and ducks and people. The reservoirs have been listed for microcystin. The region board staff right now is currently working on their 303 delisting for microcystin below Iron Gate. And we've had some people from UC Santa Cruz working on publications. We're working on publications to get them out and have peer-reviewed literature. And then there's, you know, what's going to be happening in the future. So, thank you. You all seem to stay awake. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Thank you. Erica, parents?
What? You guys hear me okay? I My name is Erica Terrence, and I'm the new Klamath Riverkeeper, and I said hello to most of you earlier. So I want to thank you guys for taking up this issue. It seems like it's been a long time in coming, and I don't have to remind you that you all are serving as some of the most important safeguards of clean water. But I am here to remind you, more importantly, today that the Klamath Riverkeeper takes that charge very seriously as well. Our mission is also to protect clean water, and the Clean Water Act is a pretty strong tool. And so we're here to make sure that water quantity and quality are protected in the Klamath particularly, and that public trust resources, the river, the aquatic species in the river, are protected. And so, again, we're glad to see you take up the TMDL for the main stem. We're here one way or another to help you do that job. It can get very technical and complex, as you started to hear today, and I'm sure you've already heard bits and pieces of the data sets. But I'm also here to remind all of us that in light of some recent developments, the TMDLs become even more important. We just saw an agreement in principle for dam removal come out. And subsequently, as you all probably know, the 401 permitting process delayed contingent on a final dam removal agreement. And in terms of protecting water quality, it's not acceptable to people living on the river and using the river who Klamath Riverkeeper represents to go silent on the Clean Water Act, not to offer some guidelines, some standards. Again, I want to emphasize here that the the TMDL process has just bumped up in importance, and we're now looking to the TMDL to do more. In other words, the burden has shifted a little bit, and we're looking to the Water Board and to you folks for some guidance on water quality standards, on nutrients, particularly on toxic algae. The agreement in principle says that at the earliest we'll see dam removal in 2020. Earliest. So the dams are still in until then. We still have a public health threat of toxic algae. We still have fish dying of really high disease rates. We still don't have enough money to study a lot of those things. All of this, again, points towards the importance of picking up this TMDL process in a timely way and completing it. There's a court order that says that needs to be completed, and it's the least we could do for the residents of the basin. So we look forward to getting into the details, but I really just wanted to give an overview, and I think we all of us here would like to get into the business of restoring the river, and I hope that we're all able to do that together and get down to working together and implementing rather than arguing over, well, how enforceable is this, or did we use the best available science? You guys have better things to do with your resources, and so do we. So, again, thank you for taking up the issue. I hope we have a lot of communication on this in the near future. I hope there's no delay. And I'm sure we'll be talking about it more soon.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? The staff summation, final comment, thoughts? Always comes back to the board for any final comments. We will see it again in January.
This is Samantha Olson again. I just want to respond quickly. We're going to bring this in more detail back in January, but a comment like that worries me because our TMDL load allocations are only as good as the enforcement mechanisms that are available to this board. And so I hope there's not a misunderstanding about our enforcement mechanism for the reservoir. So I just want to say for the record that our enforcement mechanism is primarily the 401 by the State Water Board. So in other words, take state line, and we're going to get into a lot of detail in January, but our state line load allocation to Oregon is only as good as the tools that Oregon has to reduce its loads in its jurisdiction. So hopefully there's not too much confusion about that.
Anybody want to make a comment? We have just the agreement in principle. It's not an item before us. It's timely, other than that.
It is timely, and I did want to say something about that. At least make a comment about that. Backing up just a minute, I'd like to compliment Clayton on the staff report and the presentation and acknowledge Matt St. John's work as well. I think they provided some important clarification from our last meeting, improving on some concepts that we're all trying to grasp. And their work on this, I think, is really helping advance that. Also in that staff report is mention of the AIP. And I think we need to recognize this is a parallel process right now to TMDL development. And I think what I'd like to do is just take a minute to read this, because I think that it's actually a really important piece that was presented here that I don't think has really been articulated yet. We're kind of dancing around it a little bit, but it says here, as presented to us in our agenda, it says, on November 13th, 2008, the federal government, the state of California, and the state of Oregon, and PacifiCorp issued a press release announcing an agreement in principle to remove four Klamath River dams. The AIP is included for your review, which we have. Now, most importantly here, the Regional Water Board is not a party to that agreement, and the Klamath River TMDL is being developed to accommodate both dams in and dams out conditions. A final agreement could affect the TMDL implementation schedule if the FERC relicensing and accompanying water quality certification processes before the State Water Board process is altered. And staff are working right now in sort of a state of flux. With that, we're not party to the agreement in principle. However, our board is going to eventually have to vote on the TMDL, however it dovetails into the AIP. And so what I would like to do right now is, I don't know if this is something that would require a motion or just would like to be sort of a recommendation, is for our staff or EO to figure out how we can best interact with the signatory parties, how we can work with them to identify any gaps and come up with offer up collaborative solutions. And so if that requires a motion, I would like to give one forward to give staff a little bit of guidance to do some exploring and see how well we can fit and work with this.
The legal beagle's okay? You want a motion or more direction?
I don't think a motion is necessary. Just the direction is noted, and we'll note for the record that the board members are shaking their heads. Yes, though.
Yeah, I think board member comments. I mean, I think it's fairly straightforward and stated well. Mr. Moore?
Any idea if Oregon's doing the same? Do we have any information? Oregon does feed into those dams and that process too?
Yeah, Oregon is actually represented in the negotiations because they don't operate as an independent board as you do.
Then I would echo with Jeff Hale that you go forth and take the ball and run with it.
And are we, I mean, these efforts, they occur where? We don't know sometimes, or do they invite us in, or how will that work?
I don't know. I will need to do some exploring. I've had some preliminary conversations with some of the folks who are signatory to the Klamath Settlement Agreement. Also spoken with folks at the State Board, and I think at some level, as an agency that has regulatory authority, I don't think we necessarily need to have an invitation. Of course, it would always be better to have one. And so I think one of the things I would try to do is try to seek getting some kind of an invitation so that we would be welcomed at the table and our role would be clear at the table, and that we wouldn't be signing any agreement, and I would be needing to preserve any, well, the authority of the board. And so just making that really clear in the process.
Is that similarly true, too, for the TMDL with Clayton alluded to, the Klamath Strait Strain, Lost River process? Is that also potentially true there? Do we participate in the Strait Strain process, TMDL, with Oregon at all? I see Clayton.
The Lost River is being done by US EPA, the California portion, and we have commented extensively on that document and a lot of the staff work, in fact, leading to it. We aren't doing that TMDL because our resources were cut, and it was a matter of what could we get done with what we have and do a good job. And so we deferred the Lost River in California to US EPA, and then they will give a load allocation to Oregon for that will then go into the Klamath River.
So the Lost River portion, California Lost River TMDL, will be a technical TMDL from EPA with no implementation on it, and then we'll pick up the implementation at some point.
Clayton tells me that Oregon will be giving Klamath Strait Strain an allocation.
Thank you, Clayton.
All right. Well, I think you hear concurrence by the board, the executive officers should interact and be engaged in this process. It's well for us to the agreement principle and all those settlement discussions are a big moving effort out there that can help or complicate what we also have to move. And hopefully move forward in parallel fashion. It's good to be engaged, and I think the direction would be that your board is saying to go forth, invitation or not. So. With a smile, always. Okay, that's the end of Klamath this month. It will be back next month. Okay, we'll roll forward. Item 9 is being held or will be back another time. The California fire is not